The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 7th, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Governors impose Ebola quarantines. What happened? The battle to prevent an Ebola outbreak in the U.S. took a chaotic turn this week as the federal government and state governors battled over different approaches to monitor those returning from fighting the virus in West Africa. Last week, a doctor who had worked with Ebola patients in Guinea was diagnosed with the virus 6 days after returning home to New York City. Dr. Craig Spencer rode subways and went to a bowling alley before he felt any symptoms, a time when health officials say people infected with the virus are not contagious. His Ebola diagnosis nonetheless sparked a public uproar. The governors of New York, New Jersey, and Illinois then announced that anyone flying into their states who may have been exposed to Ebola would be quarantined for the virus's maximum 21-day incubation period, even if they were asymptomatic. When this policy prompted fierce criticism from federal health officials and healthcare workers, led by a nurse, Casey Hickox, who was held for 3 days in an isolation tent in New Jersey, Governors Andrew Cuomo and Chris Christie partially retreated and said the quarantine could be spent at home, not in government custody. The obligation of elected officials is to protect the public health of all the people, said Christie. That's what we'll continue to do. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said that U.S. troops building Ebola treatment centers in West Africa, where the disease has killed nearly 5,000 people, would be quarantined before returning home, even though they have no direct contact with patients. UN officials said Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone were in desperate need of 5,000 additional healthcare workers, warning that stigmatizing such workers would undermine their efforts to isolate and treat Ebola patients and stop the epidemic from spreading. What the editorial said: Cuomo and Christie made the right call in imposing mandatory quarantine, said the New York Daily News. When it emerged that Spencer had carried Ebola all over the city before he became ill, it caused understandable panic among New Yorkers. Even if the risks of infection are small, it's better to proceed with an abundance of caution. There is absolutely no public health justification for mandatory quarantine, said the New York Times. Health workers aren't infectious if they aren't sick, and they know it's in their interest to ensure that if symptoms do arise, they get care quickly to improve their chances of survival. Christie's cynical decision to lock up Hickox like a rabid animal makes no logical sense, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. Should the doctors and nurses who treated quarantined patients be quarantined themselves? How about the crews who decontaminated quarantined homes? Where does this stop? What the columnist said: the national discourse on Ebola has become dumber, more hysterical, and more politicized, said Elia Isquith in Salon.com. For that, we can thank Christie and his reckless, cynical, and willfully theatrical intervention. With his eye on the 2016 presidential elections, the power-hungry demagogue will clearly do anything to play to the conservative base and reinforce his reputation as a straight-shooting tough guy. The problem of Ebola in America isn't about Ebola alone, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. It's also about panic. If people fear airplanes, hospitals, and public places, it can cause serious economic damage. It's not enough for experts to tell people they shouldn't be scared because the science says so. Besides, the science on Ebola isn't settled, said James Hamblin in TheAtlantic.com. Most people assume that if a patient doesn't have a fever, he or she is not infectious. Yet according to a New England Journal of Medicine report, 13% of victims in the current outbreak did not have a documented fever. Mandatory quarantines will provide only illusory safety, said Dr. Rick Sacra in USA Today. To avoid being treated like criminals, people returning from West Africa will go under the radar, lying about their potential exposure there or coming into the country through some alternate route without notifying health officials. The smartest and safest approach is a system of monitoring that encourages frequent contact between returnees and their local health departments. Jeb Bush likely to run. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush this week fueled speculation that he is gearing up for a presidential run in 2016, telling a Nashville audience that he will decide by the end of the year whether to seek the Republican Party's nomination. His son, George P. Bush, told an interviewer that it's more than likely his father will run, and the New York Times reported that Jeb's brother, George W. Bush, and father, George H. W. Bush, were the top cheerleaders for a third Bush presidency. Bush is popular with the GOP establishment, but his support for Common Core educational standards and immigration reform places him at odds with much of the party's conservative base. A Bush run would be good for the country, said Ruth Marcus in WashingtonPost.com, if only because the GOP has veered off the ideological rails. Bush is an old-fashioned conservative who believes that government can play a useful role and who advocates bipartisan cooperation. His nomination would herald a return to a saner Republican Party and lead to saner, more productive politics. Being the son of one ex-president and the brother of another has its advantages, said Chan Lowe in the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. But read my lips and mission accomplished aren't exactly the kind of slogans you want to ride into battle with. If he does run, Bush will struggle to win the Republican nomination, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. This is a man who once called the decision of illegal immigrants to cross the border an act of love. Convictions like that might make him a strong general election candidate, but a bad primary one. The very thought of a third Bush presidency feels distinctly un-American, said Timothy Stanley in CNN.com. This country, after all, was born from a violent rejection of hereditary rule. Journalists might love the idea of a Bush versus Clinton grudge match, but is it really healthy for American democracy forever to be looking backward? Our controversy of the week. Midterm elections. Is dark money eroding democracy? No matter which party comes out on top next week, said Evan Osnos in NewYorker.com, this election will go down in history as the money midterms. A staggering $4 billion is being spent on 2014 congressional campaigns, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, making these the most expensive midterms in history. Nearly $900 million of that total will be spent by super PACs and other outside groups, including $14 million that a mysterious Kentucky group has spent to label Democrat Allison Lundergan Grimes anti-coal, badly damaging her campaign against Republican Senator Mitch McConnell. The numbers are obscene, said Michael Tomasky in TheDailyBeast.com. But even more worrying is the rise of what's known as dark money. Thanks to the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling in 2010, the nation's plutocrats, such as the notorious Koch brothers, can now donate unlimited sums to so-called social welfare groups without ever having to publicly disclose their names or the size of their contributions. You can bet, however, that when bought and paid for lawmakers take their seats this January, they'll remember who wrote the checks. Actually, said Fred Barnes in the Weekly Standard, Democrats are the real party of the rich in these elections. Republicans may have the edge in undisclosed donations, but liberal PACs and super PACs are outspending their conservative equivalents by $270.5 million to $181.1 million. This cycle's most generous single donor is Tom Steyer, the billionaire environmentalist who's spending $58 million of his own money to get Democrats elected. The playing field is roughly level, said David Brooks in the New York Times, and the evidence indicates that campaign spending isn't very effective anyway. In 2012, Karl Rove's American Crossroads spent $117 million, and 90% of his candidates lost. The economist Steve Levitt has found that if you double a candidate's spending, it increases his or her vote totals just 1%. After a certain point, more negative TV ads are just making the rubble bounce. Ignore the hand-wringing. We should all relax about campaign spending. How come the candidates don't think so? Asked Norm Ornstein in the NationalJournal.com. Lawmakers of both parties now spend much of their time desperately pandering to big donors or shaking them down, rather than serving the needs of constituents. Even worse, lobbyists now can tell a congressman or senator that if he or she doesn't vote the right way on that particular bill, there are anonymous donors who, with more money than God, prepared to fund a flood of vicious personal attacks at the next election. The result has been more extremism and less compromise in Congress, and the ongoing downward spiral of the public's trust in government. Democracy itself is in peril, said Timothy Egan in NYTimes.com. Campaigns and Washington itself are controlled by the rich, the secret, the few. That's one of the many reasons Congress's approval rating sits at a record low of 7%. With only 29% of voters saying they're enthusiastic about voting this year. The name Citizens United is now heavy with tragic irony, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. 4 years on, the Supreme Court's precedent-shattering decision has succeeded only in deepening our divisions and turning more citizens into bystanders. Those corrosive trends will continue unless citizens demand their democracy back. Well, it was a good week for adaptation after Pope Francis declared that believing in the Big Bang and evolution is not inconsistent with Christianity. God is not a magician with a magic wand, Francis said, but a creator who set everything in motion with internal laws. It was a good week for breaking up after a London woman put her imaginary friend up for sale on eBay. My psychiatrist recommended that I say goodbye to Bernard, said Georgia Horrocks, age 22. She wants compensation, but said it was important that he finds a good home. It was a good week for getting run over after Oprah Winfrey's SUV squashed a woman's foot outside a Miami restaurant. She couldn't have been nicer, said Lori Bender. When I told her I was fine, she said, "Well, that's worth a picture." And we took some photos. It was a bad week for wet willies after Riley Swearingen of Minnesota thought it would be funny to lick his index finger and stick it in a cop's ear. Citing bodily fluid contact, police charged him with a felony. It was a bad week for sighing on the job after a British professor was suspended for giving off negative vibes. A supervisor at the University of Warwick disciplined Thomas Docherty for inappropriate sighing, making ironic comments, and projecting negative body language. And it was a bad week for guilty consciences after a Chinese man fell into a container of raw sewage while taking a shortcut home from a bar in an effort to avoid his wife's wrath. Chi Fang said that when he came home covered in filth, his wife ordered him to sleep in the doghouse. "The dog didn't even want to be near me," Chi said. Turn now to the briefing page. The battle over assisted suicide. A growing number of states are contemplating death with dignity laws. What is the experience with such laws thus far? What is death with dignity? Advocates of right to die laws believe that terminally ill patients facing great suffering and debilitation should have the right to control the timing and circumstances of their deaths. The right to die movement gained momentum in the 1980s and 90s primarily as a reaction to the rapid medical and technological advances, including artificial respirators, feeding tubes, and dialysis machines that were enabling doctors to keep people with cancer, Alzheimer's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, and other dreadful diseases alive for years and to prolong life beyond what many perceive to be its natural boundaries. In 1997, Oregon became the first state to legalize assisted suicide with its Death with Dignity law, approved by a voter referendum. In recent weeks, Brittany Maynard, a 29-year-old newlywed recently found to have terminal brain cancer, has campaigned to extend similar laws to other states. Maynard has said she wants to avoid the final stages of her illness, in which the fast-growing tumor could leave her in great pain, demented, and unable to speak or respond to her family. "I do not want to die," Maynard says, "but I am dying, and I want to die on my own terms." She says she plans to take a legally prescribed dose of lethal drugs around November 1st. Is there a right to die? That debate is at the heart of a major moral and philosophical debate. Currently, 5 U.S. states allow doctors to prescribe lethal doses of prescription medications to terminally ill patients who request them. Washington State legalized assisted suicide a decade after Oregon, and lawsuits in Montana, 2009, and New Mexico, 2013, resulted in court rulings upholding the legality of physician-assisted suicide. Last year, Vermont's legislature passed a law permitting physician-assisted suicide. 7 states are debating similar laws, and the nationwide advocacy group Compassion and Choices has been actively lobbying for a ballot initiative in California, which nearly 2/3 of residents polled said they would support if the election were held today. "People are resolute in their desire to have the option available," said Compassion and Choices President Barbara Coombs Lee. How about the rest of the world? European nations in particular are far more accepting of the right to die. Assisted suicide, in which doctors prescribe lethal drugs but do not administer them, is legal in Switzerland, Germany, and Albania, as well as in Colombia, Japan, and the Canadian province of Quebec. The Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg allow terminally ill patients to be euthanized by a doctor. Many of these countries' death with dignity laws do not have the same restrictions as those in the U.S., which require patients to be truly dying and to go through an extensive screening process. Opponents of the Death with Dignity movement in the U.S. point to Europe as an example where the slippery slope might lead. "I used to be a supporter of the Dutch law," said Theo Boer, who reviewed euthanasia deaths for a government committee. But in the Netherlands, Bohr said, legalizing euthanasia turned out to be wrong, terribly wrong. Why does he say that? In the Netherlands, a sick person need not be dying to qualify for euthanasia. He or she need only get two doctors to agree that there is great suffering and no chance of improvement. Last year, Bohr said, more than 40 people suffering from depression or other mental illnesses requested and received euthanasia, including a 47-year-old depressed mother of two who said she couldn't continue living with persistent tinnitus or ringing in her ears. Assisted deaths have grown 15% a year since 2008 and may hit 6,000 this year. Some slopes truly are slippery, Bohr says. In Belgium, two congenitally deaf twins chose to be euthanized because they could not bear the prospect of losing their sight. The same doctor who performed that procedure also helped end the life of a 44-year-old transsexual whose sex change operation had left him looking like a monster. Belgium recently extended the right to die to incurably ill children. In Switzerland, the organization Dignitas has been so aggressive in promoting assisted suicide that suicide tourists are traveling to the country to take their own lives under medical supervision. Will that happen in the U.S.? It depends on how laws are written. Death with Dignity advocates point to the experience in Oregon, where only about 1,170 terminally ill Oregonians, around 70 a year, have obtained a lethal prescription to end their own lives since 1997. Only 752 of them actually took the medication. The experience in other states has been very similar. Dick Walters, a retired department store manager who led the campaign to bring a Death with Dignity law to Vermont, said such laws will be used by very few, but bring comfort to anyone who fears a prolonged, painful, and debilitating death. Walters was recently given a diagnosis of lung cancer. I have peace of mind knowing that if someday in the future my suffering becomes intolerable, he says, I will have choice and control. And our best columns. We'll take two this week from the U.S. The first from Ezra Klein at Vox.com. Why Warren should run for president. Elizabeth Warren should run for president, said Ezra Klein. The Democratic senator from Massachusetts has repeatedly insisted she won't seek her party's nomination. But in recent weeks, she's changed her emphatic no to a vague, I don't think so. Her chances of beating Hillary Clinton in a Democratic primary are slim, but there are plenty of reasons she should run anyway. Warren is a true rarity in modern politics. She actually has something to say. The former Harvard professor came to a national prominence with her passionate campaign to regulate Wall Street and protect the middle class from predatory financial institutions. She's in politics, in other words, because she cares about policy. Recent history shows that the best way to advance your ideas is to run for president. It was only after John Edwards and Hillary Clinton focused on universal health care, for example, that candidate Barack Obama made it a priority. If she runs, Warren won't risk her Senate seat and will force Clinton to address her coziness with Wall Street. What has Warren got to lose? And from David Schiffman at Slate.com, politicians who scorn science. I am not a scientist. That, said David Schiffman, has become the favorite cop-out of politicians who adopt populist, anti-intellectual positions on climate change, evolution, and fracking. This exasperating evasion is a cowardly way to avoid answering basic and important policy questions. If you're a policymaker in the modern world, you are required to make frequent decisions on complex problems outside your primary area of expertise. To do this, a policymaker must consult with experts in that field, do some additional homework, and come to a reasonable position. What if policymakers said they couldn't take action to maintain highways, bridges, and tunnels because they're not civil engineers? Should senators and congressmen fail to have farm policy because they're not farmers? Or a policy on addressing the threat of ISIS because they're not generals? No one would ever say these things because they're ridiculous. On climate change, 97% of climate scientists agree that it is real, man-made, and a major threat that demands a policy response. When a policymaker says, "I'm not a scientist," to excuse an ignorant, politically expedient position, what he's really saying is, "I am not qualified to make decisions." And this column from Canada, facing the threat of homegrown jihadists. Canada, it seems, is under siege from within, said Michelle Mandel in the Toronto Sun. In the space of 3 days last week, homegrown terrorists murdered two Canadian soldiers. First, Martin Couture Rouleau, a 25-year-old Muslim convert and sympathizer of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ran down two soldiers in Quebec, killing one before being shot dead by police. Less than 48 hours later, Michael Zehaf Bibeau, another Canadian-born convert, walked up to an Army reservist standing sentry at the tomb of the unknown soldier in Ottawa and shot him twice at point-blank range. As Corporal Nathan Carrillo, a 24-year-old father of one, lay dying on the ground, Zehaf Bibeau stormed Parliament, where he was killed in a firefight with guards. Ever since the terrorist atrocities of September 11, 2001, Canadians have wondered, "When us?" said Scott Thompson in the Hamilton Spectator. We now have the answer. Canada will never be the same. Our conservative government is already acting as if ISIS has landed on our shores, said the Globe and Mail in an editorial. Prime Minister Stephen Harper vowed to further strengthen our already strict anti-terrorism laws, saying he will give authorities more powers to preemptively detain suspected extremists and prosecute people who promote militant Islamic online, like Couture Rouleau, whose Facebook page was filled with pro-ISIS posts. But such legislation would not have prevented last week's attacks. Couture Rouleau was already on a terrorism watch list. In addition, his passport had been seized to stop him from flying to the Mideast and joining ISIS. And he was interviewed by police just 2 weeks before he went on the rampage. Zehaf Bibeau, meanwhile, was on no one's radar, said André Picard, also in the Globe and Mail. The 32-year-old had a long history of mental illness and drug addiction and told a friend he was being pursued by the devil. Our health service failed this troubled soul and left him vulnerable to the apocalyptic online propaganda pumped out by the jihadists. If we are going to stop such disturbed young men from killing themselves and others, we are going to need at least as much compassion as crackdown. What Canada does next will define our nation for decades to come, said Andrew Coyne in the National Post. We can and should increase funding for the police and intelligence services, and we should attempt to understand the causes of homegrown terrorism. But we cannot stop every attack, and we shouldn't try, not only for the astronomic cost entailed, but more for the cost to our national spirit. Another lone wolf terrorist will inevitably strike in the future. But just as we live with the reality that a certain number of murders will take place every year, we can live with this. Canadians cannot harden every target, but we can stiffen our spines. And we turn to the last word, our in-depth article. This one titled, A Bolt from Above. Each year, hundreds of people survive being struck by lightning, said Ferris Jobber. Their minds are forever altered. Michael Utley does not remember much about his death. Over the years, he has woven together a narrative of what happened using threads collected from witnesses, friends, and family. On May 8, 2000, Utley, a 48-year-old stockbroker, was golfing with his coworkers Dick Gill and Bill Todd, along with their friend Jim Sullivan, in the village of Pocosset, Massachusetts, about 3 miles south of the Cape Cod Canal. Shortly after lunch, the dark clouds that had been mushrooming in the distance all morning were hovering close enough to merit the bleating of the course's storm horn. Time to clear the green. Gill, Todd, and Sullivan immediately headed toward the clubhouse. Utley walked back to the hole and returned the flagstick. Seconds later, the guys in front heard a thunderous crack and turned to see Utley stumbling to the ground, tendrils of smoke curling off his body. Their friend had collapsed in a single perplexing instant. His shoes were several feet away from his body. His fingers looked as if they had been flambéed. His eyebrows and wavy chestnut hair were wiry and crisped. Gill, an ex-Marine who had recently taken a refresher course in CPR, ran to Utley's side, began blowing air into his lungs, and instructed Todd to perform chest compressions. As Sullivan rushed off to get help, the clouds unleashed a deluge of rain and hail. Utley cannot recall any of this, not the arrival of the paramedics, nor having his heart restarted in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. His first memory after leaving the golf course is of waking up in a different ambulance. Tubes down his throat, monitors everywhere, and a paramedic in a blue smock at his feet. "Where am I?" Utley rasped. "You're on your way to rehab," the paramedic said. "What the blank happened?" "You were struck by lightning 38 days ago." In popular culture, to be hit by a bolt of lightning is to suffer extremely bad luck. Rain, snow, and hail are largely indiscriminate. Within a certain radius, everything is drenched, blanketed, or pelted. A cloud-to-ground lightning bolt is different. It blazes a discrete path through the sky. It appears to have choice. When lightning hits a human being, a survivor must reconcile not only what happened, but why it happened. Why me? For most victims, it is not the unforgettable horror of an agonizing ordeal that haunts them. Many can't even recall the incident itself. It's the mysterious physical and psychological symptoms that emerge, often long after the immediate wounds have healed and doctors have cleared them to return to their normal routines. But nothing is normal anymore. Chronic pain, memory trouble, personality changes, and mood swings can all follow an encounter with lightning, leaving friends and family members confused, while survivors, grappling with a fundamental shift in identity, feel increasingly alienated by the incomprehensible nature of their condition. Even more confounding is that almost no one in the mainstream medical community can explain what's happening to them. Although many scientists have spent their careers examining the physics of lightning, only a handful of doctors have devoted themselves to the study of how lightning damages the human body. The incident rates are simply not high enough to warrant an entire subfield of science. True entry and exit wounds are uncommon, but lightning typically leaves some kind of mark on the skin. One afternoon in 2009, a hiker named Becky Garris awoke on the Appalachian Trail in Vermont. sitting on a bed of pine needles, her back against a tree, as though she'd fallen asleep in its shade. Her right arm was paralyzed, pinned against her chest in a pledge of allegiance. Here and there, her pants were charred. Although she was disoriented and scared, she managed to hike more than 10 muddy miles down Glastonbury Mountain to call for help. When she got to a hospital, doctors recognized Lightning's smoldering touch on Garris's right arm and leg. A bolt probably hit her directly, they said. Other survivors awaken into temporary blindness or deafness. Sometimes the concussive force of the strike or the electricity itself ruptures eardrums. Some victims report the taste of metal on their tongues. Now and then, survivors develop strangely beautiful pink and brown bruises known as Lichtenberg figures, which look like intricate henna tattoos of branching fronds. These bruises likely trace the path of electricity that forced blood cells out of capillaries into more superficial layers of skin. In rare instances, the surge of electricity is enough to stop a victim's heart and lungs. That's what happened to Utley. But cardiac arrest is something any paramedic knows how to handle. 20 minutes after Utley was struck, EMTs had arrived on the scene, strapped him to a gurney, and loaded him into an ambulance. They used a defibrillator to keep his heart going. After leaving the hospital for rehab 5 weeks later, Utley spent months relearning to swallow, move his fingers, and walk. Rehab was just the first chapter of his ordeal, however. In his previous life, Utley was a successful stockbroker who often went skiing and windsurfing. Today, at 62, he lives on disability insurance in Cape Cod. "I don't work," he says. "I can't work. My memory's fried, and I don't have energy like I used to. I aged 30 years in a second. I walk and talk and play golf, but I still fall down. I'm in pain most of the time. I can't walk 100 yards without stopping. I look like a drunk." Lightning also dramatically altered his personality. "It made me a mean, ornery son of a bitch. I'm short-tempered. Nothing is fun anymore. I am just not the same person my wife married," said Utley, who is now divorced. Like many survivors, Utley sees his fateful union with Lightning as more than just a close call he was lucky to survive. It marks a moment in which he was split from himself. On a typical summer afternoon, thunderclouds above the continental United States generate an average of 50,000 lightning flashes per hour. Two-thirds of these stay near the heavens. They pierce the sky with branching networks of blue and white fire, or strike out a short distance in thin tongues of electricity, or illuminate clouds from within like muffled firecrackers. The remaining minority of lightning bolts, however, find an earthbound target: a church steeple, a telephone pole, a tree. Even rarer are bolts that directly strike and kill humans. Not surprisingly, the vast majority of these fatalities in the U.S. happen in June, July, and August, the months when thunderstorms are more prevalent and the greatest number of Americans are recreating outside. According to a recent National Weather Service analysis, fishing, boating, swimming, and camping put the most people at risk each year. Last July, two visitors in Colorado's Rocky Mountain National Park were killed by separate strikes on the same weekend. When people and lightning meet, however, death is an unlikely outcome. Roy Cleveland, a ranger at Shenandoah National Park in Virginia, survived a record 7 strikes from 1942 to 1977. This fact appears to defy logic. An average lightning bolt carries 500 megajoules of energy, enough to instantly boil 250 gallons of water. It heats the air it zips through to 5 times the surface temperature of the sun. Still, around 90% of lightning strike victims survive. Over the past three decades, lightning has killed an average of 51 people per year in the U.S., but left more than 500 injured and alive. One explanation is that lightning strikes are fundamentally different from the more common high-voltage electrical accidents. When an electrician inadvertently grabs a live wire, far less current typically seizes him than is contained in a lightning bolt. But it does so for a longer duration. The surge of current causes the victim to lose control, rendering them unable to let go. After a few seconds, the electricity coursing through the body has enough time to sear internal organs and interrupt the heart. Lightning strikes, lasting less than a half millionth of a second, often scorch the skin, but don't cause internal burns. Just as crucial, most of the electricity in a lightning bolt does not pass through the body. Rather, it dissipates over the skin in what's known as a flashover. Vernon Kure, a lightning scientist at Uppsala University in Sweden, explains the phenomenon by contrasting the ways a human body and a tree react when struck. Both trees and people are filled with a soup of water and minerals that conduct electricity pretty well. But because trees are covered in dry, inelastic bark, lightning traveling through the trunk has no escape route. It must stay its course. In the process, it superheats the water and sap inside the tree into explosive steam, which can rip apart the trunk and branches. Compared with tree bark, human skin is much more pliant and moist. Sweat and rainwater make it extra conductive, providing an alternate external path for voltage. Most of the electricity can pass over strike victims rather than coursing through them. The path through the body has much greater resistance than the path around the body, says Vladimir Rokov, a University of Florida researcher and a leading authority on lightning physics. Current always chooses the path of least resistance. A flashover can still do damage indirectly. The electricity crackling over the surfaces of the human body singes clothing, vaporizes sweat and moisture into scalding steam, and renders metal objects like belt buckles, keys, and jewelry so hot that they burn the skin. Occasionally, all that steam even blows victims' shoes and socks off. For Utley, getting adequate treatment after he recovered was a struggle. He was eventually fortunate enough to find a few doctors who helped him cope with the long-term symptoms. But along the way, he met many medical experts who understood little or nothing about his injuries. Finding a doctor who knows anything about a lightning strike is next to impossible, said Tamara Pandolf Perry, 46, who was struck by lightning in August 2010 in the parking lot of the Springfield, Illinois men's warehouse where she worked. Following her accident, Pandolf Perry forgot how to use everyday objects, like a potato peeler. She could no longer get from point A to point B in her hometown. She suffered migraines and fatigue. She tripped over her sentences. She was often dizzy and off balance. And every now and then, when her nerves were on fire, even the slightest touch was painfully intense. I struggled with why me initially, she says. There was a time I was angry. I think I got past that part. You can be angry and hold on to that, and it can ruin everything you have left. Utley, too, has trained his mind on the future. Despite the personality change and the relentless pain, despite the hunger for an explanation that would make sense of it all, he no longer fixates on a why that probably doesn't exist. Yeah, I was pissed at first, Utley says. Why did I get struck and not the three guys 15 feet away from me? There's no rhyme or reason. You can ask questions all you want, but it's like yelling at the ocean. It does not answer back. This article was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the October 2014 issue of Outside magazine. And we'll read one of the obituaries this week. The newspaper editor who brought down a president. Ben Bradley, 1921 to 2014. In February 1965, Newsweek Washington bureau chief Ben Bradley went for lunch with Katherine Graham, the Washington Post new publisher. When Graham asked Bradley about his career ambitions, the Navy veteran didn't mince his words. "I'd give my left one to be managing editor of the Post," he declared. Within 3 years, Bradley got his dream job. Over the next two decades, he became the most celebrated editor of his generation, overseeing the Post's release of the Pentagon Papers and ultimately helping bring down President Richard Nixon with the Watergate scandal. "I came along at the right time with the right job," he said, "and I didn't screw it up." Benjamin Crowan Shield Bradley was born in Boston into the New England WASP aristocracy, said the Daily Telegraph. At 14, he was temporarily paralyzed by polio. His long and painful rehabilitation left him with an impressive barrel-chested physique that he never lost. He studied at Harvard University before serving as a naval officer for the last 3 years of World War II. After being discharged, Bradley began his journalism career by co-founding a New Hampshire newspaper with friends. He then had a brief stint at the Washington Post, before moving to Paris in 1951 to work as the press attaché at the American Embassy. He returned to the U.S. in 1958 to work as a Washington correspondent for Newsweek and struck up a firm friendship with his new neighbor, a young John F. Kennedy. Bradley's inside track on Kennedy's 1960 presidential campaign elevated him from rookie status at Newsweek, said the New York Times. The following year, he persuaded Philip Graham, then publisher of the Post, to buy the magazine. In return, Bradley was given enough Post stock to live as a wealthy man. 2 years after Graham's suicide in 1963, his widow, Catherine, brought Bradley into the fold, and he set about transforming the Post from a locally oriented newspaper into a lively, well-written daily that competed with the New York Times, said the Los Angeles Times. He hired a slew of talented journalists and introduced Style, a women's section with humor, flash, and bite. In 1971 came one of Bradley's proudest moments, defying a court order to publish the leaked Pentagon Papers, a highly classified history of U.S. involvement in Vietnam. The Nixon administration tried to stop publication, as it had done successfully with the New York Times, but the Supreme Court ultimately sided with the newspapers. Then came the story that, in Bradley's words, "put us all on the map," said the Washington Post. In June 1972, five burglars were caught breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in Washington's Watergate complex. The White House dismissed the crime as a third-rate burglary, but Bradley consistently supported two young reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, in their hunch that the Nixon administration was involved in the crime. They were right, and Nixon resigned in disgrace 2 years later. "He was interested in the truth," Woodward said of Bradley, "even in the face of denials and denunciation from the Nixon White House. He really didn't buckle." For all the triumphs under Bradley's watch, he also oversaw perhaps the Post's most ignominious moment, said the Wall Street Journal. In 1981, reporter Janet Cook had to hand back a Pulitzer Prize, one of 19 won by the Post under Bradley, when it emerged that her story about an 8-year-old heroin addict was entirely fabricated. Bradley, mortified, offered to resign, but his bosses turned him down. He stayed on as editor until 1991, when he retired and took up the ceremonial position of vice president at large. In his 1995 memoir, A Good Life, Bradley provided his motto for journalism: put out the best, most honest newspaper you can today and put out a better one the next day. On the health and science page, new hope for spinal cord injuries. In a major breakthrough, a paralyzed man is walking again after cells from his own nose were transplanted into his broken spinal cord. Bulgarian firefighter Derek Fidya, 40, was paralyzed from the waist down 4 years ago when a knife attack partially severed his spinal cord. 2 years of rehabilitation had no effect, and in 2012, Fidka underwent experimental treatment involving olfactory ensheathing cells, specialist cells in the nasal cavity that help the sense of smell return after nasal damage. A team of British and Polish doctors removed one of Fidka's two olfactory bulbs and used it to grow 500,000 of the specialist cells in the laboratory. They then injected these cells at both ends of the tear in the spinal cord and bridged the gap between them with four thin strips of nerve tissue taken from Fidka's ankle. The theory behind this procedure was that the cell's regenerative function would help the new bridge reconnect the severed spinal cord. It apparently worked. Within 3 months, Fidka began regaining feeling below the waist, and his withered thigh muscles started to regrow. 2 years later, he can stand upright and walk with the aid of a walker. "It's like you're born again," Fidka tells BBC.com. Neurosurgeon Paul Tabaco said further testing is needed, but that regeneration of the spinal cord, something that was thought impossible for many years, is becoming a reality. The health scare of the week, sodas speed up aging. Drinking sugary sodas has been proved to lead to obesity, diabetes, and heart attacks. Now researchers have found evidence that the drinks could also speed up the body's aging process. One of the signs of the aging process is that the caps on the end of people's chromosomes, known as telomeres, tend to shrink. When scientists at the University of California at San Francisco studied the DNA of more than 5,300 healthy Americans, they found that those who drank more sodas generally had shorter telomeres. People who drank 20 ounces of sugary drinks a day, about 21% of the sample, had telomeres reflecting an additional 4.6 years of aging, which is roughly the same effect as smoking. Researchers found no link between cell aging and diet sodas or fruit juices. "We think we can get away with drinking lots of soda as long as we are not gaining weight," senior author Elisa Epple tells CBSNews.com. "But this suggests that there is an invisible pathway that leads to accelerated aging, regardless of weight." And on the Talking Points page, 2016, Paul's foreign policy vision. Rand Paul just gave one of the most important foreign policy speeches in decades, said Zach Beauchamp and Vox.com. But instead of declaring war on another country, the Kentucky senator declared war on his own party, specifically the hyper-hawk neoconservatism that dominates GOP foreign policy. The Tea Party favorite outlined a vision of conservative realism that will characterize his likely 2016 presidential campaign. "Americans shouldn't go to war when it hasn't been directly attacked or threatened," said Paul, "or where the best outcome is stalemate. Nor should the U.S. military intervene without congressional approval. Americans yearn for leadership and for strength," he said, "but they don't yearn for war." Paul's speech was pitched to Republican voters, said Connor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com, "but it should appeal to anyone who believes that U.S. foreign policy has gone astray since 9/11. Paul's vision isn't a bad starting point, said Daniel Dresner in WashingtonPost.com, but it's still radically incomplete. The libertarian senator tears into the Libya intervention, for instance, but then doesn't really outline what criteria would justify the use of force. He declares his support for President Obama's airstrikes against ISIS, even though the strikes weren't approved by Congress and are unlikely to bring about a victory in Iraq. Paul wants to convince us he is something that he is not, said Jennifer Rubin, also in WashingtonPost.com. But strip away the senator's inconsistent promises for strong leadership, and you'll find a candidate who is against droning American jihadists and ultimately unwilling to destroy ISIS. At heart, he's nothing more than a garden variety isolationist. Paul is certainly a political shapeshifter, said Emma Roller in NationalJournal.com. He has figured out that he can become president only by appealing to the GOP's conservative core and broadening that appeal to the rest of the nation. With that in mind, Paul now tailored his message to each particular audience. In front of a majority black crowd, he touts sentencing reform. In front of a Christian conservatives, he talks about the sanctity of life. But that slipperiness could come back to bite him. Paul should remember one golden rule. To connect with one audience, you will almost inevitably alienate another. And a few notes. The FBI has files on roughly 77.7 million people in the U.S., the equivalent of one in three American adults. As many as 12,000 new names are added to its master criminal database every day, largely as the result of minor arrests connected to zero-tolerance policies at schools. And a quote for you from Philip Roth, quoted in Longview, Texas News Journal. In every calm and reasonable person, there is a hidden second person scared witless about death. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.